Welcome to MGO Podcast 5.17. We've got a dual blast of vague disappointment for you with Iowa and recruiting and, you know, three-pointers and not recruiting guys, but peppers, always peppers. Hey, so do you know what the worst part of my weekend was?
Just Michigan sports in general?
Well, yeah, and then my mom came over and gave me some stuff that I didn't really want and had to throw out immediately. So
that's fun.
But it was still a hockey game.
Penn State. They have a habit.
It was
across multiple sports, apparently.
It was disgusting. I didn't even get to see him score 7 goals the night before, which they haven't scored 7 goals in like 3 games for the previous 3 months, and then I get to see the 4-0 stinker.
So if anybody chants we own Penn State for the next like 5 years, just punch them in the face.
Or eat their jugular or something. Or, you know, I just saw the movie The Gray. And if you could make them crash in the Alaskan wilderness, that would also be an appropriate punishment. But we should talk about basketball because no one really cares about hockey except me. And the basketball, it's gone better.
We've had better weeks.
It was a series of just three-pointers making games out of hand, completely. Yes. And started with Yogi Ferrell going nuts at Indiana and then Michigan going nuts against Nebraska. And then mostly Devin Marble, but also other participants from Iowa at Iowa. And at some point, even if the defense is bad.
And it was.
Like, the kind of things that are happening to Michigan are just not reasonable things to have happen to you.
Yeah, I mean, like, I went through and...
There was a point at which Iowa was 9 of 12 from 3, and I don't care if those are all wide open. That's crazy.
Yeah, you have teams that can't shoot 9 of 12 in a shoot-around, like Northwestern and Indiana on most days. I went through and looked at every single Yogi Ferrell three-point attempt from that game, and yes, there were defensive breakdowns that led to his threes in the Indiana game, but you also have a guy who's just drilling everything if he gets even the tiniest bit of a chance to get something off, and you don't expect a guy to be able to make almost all of those, which he did. He missed one. And the same thing happened with Marble, where, Caris LeVert kind of lost him in transition, and including after made baskets a couple times, which is quite disconcerting.
We're about to get into that.
And there were transition or perimeter defense was an issue. But for Marble, who's a 35% three-point shooter, to be able to go off like that, part of that is just bad luck.
All right, so noted. And now the part that is not bad luck. Get your damn hands up!
Caris.
For a guy who's supposed to be like the defensive stopper on this team, whenever he goes up against one of the Big Ten's better players, he just gets annihilated.
He gets lit up.
I guess Taron Pettaway is an exception there, but that game was so out of hand so quickly that, how hard was Pettaway even trying in the second half?
Yeah.
But he was lit up by Gary Harris. He was lit up by Marble, and he was lit up by Yogi Ferrell. And it's just like, man, like those guys shot, I think, something like 66% from three against him, probably even worse than that. And at some point, you remember that Ben Brust shot?
I've really tried to forget, but
not that one. The one after that in the overtime session.
Yes, I do remember that one.
Where he's just there and he's just like, it's Ben Brust.
Yeah.
You need to have a hand in his face. Yeah. And for whatever reason, Michigan is not doing a very good job of closing out three-pointers. And it's not necessarily so much that Michigan is seeing these shots go in, it's that they're going up at all.
Yeah, I mean, the big thing about three-point defense is it's not the percentage you allow made. It's the percentage of shots in total that you allow that are three-pointers. Giving up the attempt is the big thing because if someone's taking a three-pointer, it usually means it's a decent look.
Right, and most of these looks were decent despite some of them coming with 3 seconds left in the shot clock, especially against Indiana because Indiana were just running every shot clock down, sometimes on purpose, sometimes just looks like they had no idea what they were doing. And Michigan does good work for 30 seconds, and then they do – nothing about the pull-up jumper that Yogi Ferrell's about to nail. So, I don't know, man. Like, their defense wasn't great last year, and it's just worse this year. And I think that's a consistent thing. And I think maybe we underrated Tim Hardaway a little bit on that end of the floor. Because he was always a mediocre defender or a poor defender. And then as his junior year came around, he actually made that a focal point.
Yeah.
And he was actually a pretty good perimeter defender, the likes of which Michigan does not have right now.
Yeah, they really don't. And I think we're also seeing, you know, that Trey Burke was a pretty solid perimeter defender, and that even though Walton's pretty, you know, is going to be pretty decent there, that yeah. there's ground to cover. There's just these marginal steps back.
Well, Walton doesn't really know what to do all the time still.
Exactly. Like, yeah, his problems are mostly off the ball. And then obviously the absence of Mitch McGarry, where you're not getting those sudden change turnovers,
yeah.
which not only generates offense, but stymies opponent possessions.
And he was also a preposterously effective defensive rebounder, which is what Michigan needs because, you know, the two guys they have in at the center are okay, but then they don't really have anyone else who's rebounding in traffic. Like, LeVert yeah. is picking up a bunch of rebounds, but not many of them are particularly contested. And then Robinson is not an impact rebounder.
No, he's not.
Despite
his defensive rebound percentage is below Levert's right now, actually, by a few points.
So in this game, the Iowa game, the most recent game, was just, if you look at the stats, it's like we are really badly missing Mitch McGarry because Mitch McGarry stole a lot of balls, forced a lot of turnovers. Iowa had 7 turnovers, and they won the steal battle 9-3. And then, of course, you just get crushed on the defensive boards. And McGarry was like just a fantastic extra shot generator.
Yes.
Which is the thing that this team could really use. And they were, I think, negative 11 against Iowa in terms of just like offensive rebounds plus turnovers. So it was a tough thing to come back from, especially when you're letting them hit almost 60% from three.
Yeah. I mean, we can Izzo this and do the McGarry angle and...
Well, it's just
but it's valid in terms of what he does on both ends of the court in terms of generating possessions, especially in a game. I mean, Michigan held Iowa to, I think this was an even slower game than the first game, technically. I think it was yeah. a 65-possession game. But Michigan wasn't able to generate second chances on it, many of their possessions at all. Iowa was. You're not, like you said, the turnover gap was large. There's just, Michigan can't win those games when they're not shooting very well. And if they're letting the other team shoot the lights out, then you end up in blowout territory.
Yep.
So this was unfortunately kind of everything bad coming together at once, I think, in a game. And that'll happen hopefully once. It happens once a year where last year's Michigan State game yeah. was a whole lot like
just
that.
Just throw something down the memory hole.
So hopefully this is a just forget about it type game where they were at Iowa. It was the toughest game on paper left on their schedule. And the good / bad news is that they get to turn around from it quickly because they have to play against Ohio State on Tuesday night.
Yeah, so. That sounds like good news. We've just found out that Nick Stauskas can be eliminated by any random 6-foot guard you happen to have lying around. And, oh, well, it's Aaron Kraft.
And they've got Shannon Scott, too, so that's
fine.
Oh,
my God. Well,
just in case, you know, one gets tired. And
right. I mean, they can't score very well, but, I mean, this is actually—
Neither could Indiana.
Well, this is actually a team where you could probably leave a lot of guys on the perimeter and they wouldn't have much of a response.
Yeah.
You know, you'd hope. I mean, I loathe to say that because I might be dooming Michigan to watch Aaron Kraft at 9 of 10 threes and for Dockett to just explode. And
well, I think McKenzie's left us off the hook on anything involving jinxes for a while.
Well, the power rankings were never KenPom-oriented power rankings. I don't.
But then he made them Ken Pom oriented, and then he diverted from that, and that was the mistake.
That is true. You never start following Ken Pom and then deviate from Ken Pom because he will punish you. Even though he is an algorithm, he will punish you.
It's a very vengeful algorithm.
A very, very vengeful algorithm. So what do we do with Stauskas now? Like now that this is the way people are defending him, how do we make it stop?
I don't know if there's a simple answer to that because it involves, I mean, we've seen Levert be able to step up offensively and be able to create off the dribble, but that still doesn't really create openings for Stauskas because his off the dribble game is slowly weave your way towards the basket until you put up this weird shot that goes
well,
in a fair amount of the time.
I don't think that's necessarily true. I mean, we saw Michigan get one backdoor cut
yes,
against Iowa, and it's just like I think you need to start doing
that,
a lot of that.
Yeah, doing that more.
And it's possible that you shouldn't be throwing that as a bounce pass. Possibly you should be throwing it up high.
As a lob.
Yeah.
Yes. And I think also they need to run Stauskas a little bit more as the point guard, which they haven't been doing as much lately, where just give him the ball right off the bat.
Yeah.
and stop letting other teams deny him the ball. He ends up being the de facto point guard a fair amount of the time anyway. He's still got the highest assist rate on the team. So,
yeah, is there any reason that he shouldn't be bringing the ball up? I mean, I know that they start with this thing where they've got the corner action and then there's the dribble handoff. But, I mean, if every possession just kind of started out with Stauskas bringing the ball up and then running a pick and roll just to see what happens, I think that would effectively bring him into the game.
Yeah, especially since they've had such success freeing him up in previous games off dribble handoffs. Why he can't bring the ball up the floor, do a running dribble handoff to somebody, and get kind of a running head start on his off-ball movement, too. There's a lot of things that him being the point guard could really help out, I think. And the downside, I'm not sure if there is much of one, considering Walton's been kind of this spot-up shooter in the offense. And now he's expanding that a little bit in the last few games, but for the most part, that's still his role.
Well, if Walton's sitting in the corner instead of Stauskas sitting in the corner, that's still a 40% three-point shooter.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't just leave him and then pay all your attention to Stauskas, as Nebraska found out
Yes.
the hard way. I mean, that was a game in which too much attention was paid to him and he was finding guys, and Michigan rained it down on him. So if he's initiating and he's got 9 points at the end of the game, but he's also got 8 assists, that's fine. Because
yeah,
amongst those assists that are another 4 or 5 good open shots that didn't happen to go down. So that way your offense is running mostly through your best offensive and most efficient offensive player instead of, say, Glenn Robinson III.
We
don't want to bag on too hard, but he had 2 points on 7 shots and turned the ball over 4 times. And every one of those turnovers was like, you know, you're in the movie theater and you're like, don't open that door. And they still open the door. It's just painful watching him try to create shots.
Yeah, him going off the dribble, he is just not quick enough with his moves. He cannot put it down hard on the floor and get to the basket. Teams clearly know to shade him to the right, and he doesn't have, when he goes to his left hand, the ball ends up in the other team's hands. So
I mean, we should give Chris Gehrig the credit. So,
yes,
while you're watching Glenn Robinson III, watch him try to dribble with his left hand and see if it ever gets him anywhere doing anything. And I think you will find the answer is no.
Yeah, thus far it has been not really at all, because Chris popped into my Twitter feed during I think it was the Purdue game, just to be like, asking the question, can he really dribble with his left hand? And I hadn't looked that closely before, but looking at it these last few games, it's been a consistent thing where when he goes to his left, he can't dribble hard off of it. He doesn't have a move where he can, you know, get back. He can't really finish with his left. And other teams are attacking that. When he gets the ball to his left hand, teams know to go after that right away, and that's what produced most of his turnovers against Iowa.
Yeah, and at this point, it's just kind of clear that he is what he is. He's a guy who can get you some garbage points. He can leap real high and finish dunks.
He's great in transition.
He's got an elbow jumper that is pretty solid.
Yeah.
And then he's a 30% three-point shooter. So Michigan managed to turn that guy into a really useful player last year, mostly because of Trey Burke. And I don't know how you get him involved, but you can't just put him on the perimeter and tell him to go make a shot. Maybe on the block.
Yeah.
We've seen a couple opportunities where he's posted a guy up, and then just because he leaps so high, he can get short jumpers whenever he wants. And then if that's your worst case scenario, then maybe you can see him.
Yeah, I mean, he's fine as a third or fourth option right now in a college offense. That's not the problem. The problem is that Michigan's still playing him like he's a number two option. Or at least that's the fan perception. They're running the offense through Stauskas and LeVert much more than they are Robinson, obviously. But in terms of what people are expecting out of Michigan.
And then when you turn Stauskas off and the team is kind of looking for some sort of direction and Robinson tries to fill that role, it's an ugly.
Yeah, well, I think the play you brought up in your game column about Robinson spending most of the shot clock trying to create a shot for himself, and then when it came time to actually create a shot at the end of the clock, he gave it off to Derek Walton, who immediately made a quick move and got to the basket and picked up a foul, I believe. And that was quite telling in terms of not only is Robinson deferring to a younger teammate, but that teammate is much more successful at getting the ball to the basket.
Well, I mean, just look at the quality of the move. I mean, that lightning quick crossover and getting into the lane is something that we've never seen from Robinson and probably never will at this point.
No.
I mean, his best bet is just to be a guy who gets you rebounds and maybe improves his corner shooting, but I just don't see him ever being a guy who you run your offense through. It's just, I mean, look at the leap that Karras made from last year to this year versus what Glenn Robinson did.
Yeah, so like, Robinson is still essentially the same player.
He's just he's a static.
I think he's made some strides defensively, but not as readily apparent.
And he has added some stuff to his game. He's added the curl, and so it's not completely the same, but his handle is just so weak that you have to know that.
And his outside shot isn't enough of a threat to really keep defenses focused on him.
Right. And I mean, right now it's just like he gets an open three from the corner and he hesitates and you're like, well, yeah, I don't know if that's a good shot either. So it's kind of a conundrum.
It is.
But we might get him back next year.
That is true.
I don't think that's going to happen no matter what. If he's a second round pick, I think he's probably going to pull the Darius Morris just because he's, going to be disappointed by that, but I think we've mentioned that before.
Yeah, and there's no way he falls out of the second round.
No. So in news that is not a massively depressing thing, Zach Irvin is really kind of coming into his own here. He had a couple of transition takes to the bucket, so I mean that's something we haven't seen before.
Established that he can make layups.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
we do have that one picture from the first Iowa game of him making a layup, so we have documented that he does go to the basket occasionally.
I mean, he's making a couple of dribbles on these, and it's not a half-court situation where you're in danger of turning the ball over.
No.
But, he's doing some stuff that is an expansion of his game, and then his shooting is really establishing itself at a very positive level. So I think he's at 42% or something from three now.
Yeah, and his 48 and 49% two-point mark looks better when you realize that most of those are long twos.
Right. So, I mean, he's just a shooter. He hasn't recorded either an assist or a turnover in the last three games.
And he's taken 10 free throws all year.
And he's got one assist in the entirety of the Big Ten season. So he's the platonic definition of just a shooter. But he is shooting an awful lot when he's on the court. He's taking 27.4% of Michigan shots when he's on the court. And that's, getting up to be 20 minutes a game. So having that volume and that efficiency is a pretty good player.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now we just have to get him to rebound and play defense and all that.
Round everything out. Although I think he's got a ton of potential for a breakout year next year with his frame and his shooting. I think he's got more. I think he's shown more off the dribble potential than Robinson.
I agree with that. I still think that, with Walton and LeVert still around, that his role is going to be mostly similar. I'm hoping that he brings it up a notch. But yeah. I don't think they're going to be running most of the offense through him.
Yeah, well, the other thing I think that can really round out for him is, I mean, the guy has a huge – he's built like a linebacker, it looks like, when you see him in person. I mean, he's got these really broad shoulders, and he's only 200 pounds right now. And I think next year we could see a guy who's a lot bigger, and if he ends up getting slotted in at the four – a guy who's going to rebound a whole lot more than what he's doing right now.
Well, I think an important thing for him to do is just start rebounding now, because, I mean, Michigan is not getting a whole lot from that four spot in terms of rebounding.
It'd be nice if he could cycle in there instead of at the three, and usually they're putting him in with Robinson on the court.
Even at the three, like, he needs to crash the boards, on offense necessarily, but he needs to do the kind of things that LeVert is doing right now, where he's going to go get some offensive rebounds. Not offensive rebounds.
Defensive rebounds.
And then I just want to see him add like kind of the Hardaway stuff to his game, because Hardaway never really developed into a guy who is going to take you off the dribble and do that stuff. But because he added the rest of the stuff to his game, his junior year was by far his best at Michigan.
Yes.
So I want him to be like Hardaway plus, because Hardaway,
that would be nice.
Hardaway is a couple inches shorter. And, I think you look at Irvin and you're looking at a guy who's pretty much the exact carbon copy, except he's a little bit more NBA friendly, which is, as a college player, I would say
he's more college friendly.
Well,
because Hardaway is shooting although Irvin's shooting is now comparing pretty favorably to Hardaway's. Hardaway's athleticism is something that made him an NBA player, and that's starting to show itself in what he's been able to do with the Knicks recently.
Yeah, well, he didn't really seem as much of an NBA player as he does now that he's in the NBA.
I just think you don't watch enough NBA.
No, I mean, I always knew that his game translated to the NBA. I just didn't think he'd be better than, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. I did know that one.
Maybe I feel like you knew that the second the Pistons drafted KCP.
Hey, man, when you can get a guy who led his team to a 500 SEC record, you got to do that.
Have to. Every time.
Every time. Got to fire that guy.
But at least they fired the head coach on the Pistons. So problem solved.
How do you fire the head coach and not the GM?
In fairness, Mo Cheeks was doing an absolutely abhorrent job.
Who brought in the worst three-point shooter in the history of the NBA. That is not an exaggeration.
No, it's not.
That is not an exaggeration.
They should still fire Dumars. Firing Cheeks was not the most inexplicable move. I'm just not happy that
when you already have two promising young post players.
Yeah, no, don't. You're preaching to the choir, man. Trust me, they should fire everybody. But Pistons are at fire everybody stage.
I'm a little punchy because
it was a rough week.
Everything is horrible.
Yeah,
but now curling's back, so I'm feeling much better. Do you know how much better curling is than every other Olympic? The Olympics are incredibly boring except for curling.
I've actually found the biathlon to be oddly, or the skiathlon, or the ones they've been showing recently have been kind of entertaining. When you combine shooting and skiing,
the biathlon is what there needs to be a winter Olympic decathlon where you like have to do mogul skiing and cross country skiing and speed skating.
I feel like this just ends in death, though, for like
it does.
80% of the competitors.
It does, and I'm okay with that because that is their Olympic dream.
The athletes must dance for us for our entertainment.
There probably shouldn't be any judge sports, so moguls is out, but they should do like downhill and speed skating. Just see what happens, man.
Yeah.
None of this like team figure skating biznaz, which is ridiculous.
You don't like it? I feel like it's just the Winter Olympics equivalent to the team gymnastics thing, and then you still get the same.
No, the team gymnastics thing is different because like everybody does
specialize
every event, right? So it's like you have to have all around people who do well. And this
I don't think everybody does every event.
Well, you have to have a team of a certain limited number of people, and then those people do a certain number of events.
The apparatuses.
So it's actually kind of an interesting tactical puzzle.
As opposed to skating where everyone's going out there and doing the same thing.
Right. And they're probably just doing the exact same routines they're going to be doing for the individual. So it's just a crass attempt to get more skating on television.
Well, it is like by far the biggest draw for the Winter Olympics, so I can see why they're doing it.
I blame women.
Darn women and watching sports and changing our television viewing experience. Are we going to have to cut that in case people take it the wrong way? I'm
no,
kidding, women
no.
who listen to this podcast, all three of you.
Yeah, Jane, we're sorry. do we have anything else to say about basketball? We're just – any complaints? Yeah, more complaints. All right, we should say they're still probably going to – I mean, they're competing for the Big Ten title.
They're still tied for first place. The outlook's still pretty
right.
darn
yeah,
good.
Yeah, so we're just you know, kind of trying to bounce off this Iowa game without committing Harry Caray.
And in terms of, you know, Michigan's got their big – one thing they have a slight edge on compared to other teams is I went through and looked at the home schedules for the top five contenders.
Mm-hmm.
And Michigan has – two home games left against the other contenders as compared to Michigan State's already lost one to Michigan and had needed overtime to beat Ohio State. And so Michigan has some scheduling advantages down the stretch compared to other teams. I just did a really poor job of saying what I was trying to say. But.
Well, they have kind of a tougher slate overall with no real pushovers except for
– That's true, but they get a lot of their home games out of the way and other teams
right.
have got
– And what is even a pushover in the Big Ten anymore?
That's true. We don't know. Northwestern keeps growing up every day.
Just a rolling ball of death. All right. So we are going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and talk about recruiting. So the recruiting came and went, and it's kind of funny because I'm looking at these names and I'm like, who are any of these guys anymore? Because the last commit that Michigan got in this class was in August.
Yeah, when I was going back to get ready for the signing day live vlog and I went back to HelloPost, it took me a while just to get past the underclassmen who'd committed since the they'd rounded out the 2014
class. I mean, and that's all well and good, you know, but
getting stuff out of the way early is nice.
Especially when you're going to go 7-6 with the most unwatchable offense in the history of college football.
Yep.
So I guess that's good, but I can't help but look at this class and think about what might have been, and also the fact that, you know, how Alabama has to cut 11 guys if they're going to have a get under 85 this year. Well, Michigan doesn't really even get up to 85 with this.
No.
I mean, they might be up to 85 depending on whether, you know, player who's a fifth-year senior X comes back, or player who's buried so deep on the depth chart he can't even see the sun anymore comes back. But functionally, they are 2, 3, maybe even 4 players short of a full class.
Yeah. Heading into this, the expectation was that this class would hit 18 to 20, and it's at 16.
Which is 4 fewer lottery tickets you have to find a player.
Yes.
And it is disappointing to me that they couldn't find anyone late that they were interested in. They couldn't pick up on anyone who they were interested in during the season. And they basically turned down Monte Nicholson for no reason whatsoever.
Yeah, and to double up on that hurt, he ends up at Michigan State.
Right, and that's a safety. And you're looking at this class and you're looking at the depth chart, like, I don't know what the heck they're thinking about when they're like, no, we don't need a safety.
No, I mean, the only thing I can think of is that they really did put all of their eggs into the Malik McDowell basket, which obviously continues to head in the wrong direction. That saga is still not over as of this recording. But, I mean, that's pretty poor management of your roster if you stop recruiting these guys entirely. And we've seen this before with this coaching staff where they stopped recruiting linebackers in the 2012 class and then kind of had to – or 2013 class and then had to kind of jump back into it. And turned down a couple guys who may have been good choices to take in the recruiting class if they had a chance. And, you know, I'm glad that this coaching staff really takes the 85 cap seriously and doesn't pull any of the Alabama-type shenanigans where they're manipulating roster numbers. At the same time, sometimes it seems like they're overly conservative in how they're managing the numbers to the point where they drop guys completely and don't contact them, and then when the need arises later in the class, when the numbers become clearer and certain players start to, you know, narrow down their own lists, Michigan seems to be kind of off guard and not prepared for those scenarios all the time.
Yeah, and they seem like deathly afraid of guys who might not qualify, and it's like, I'm glad that they're being careful about this, but, you know, you can take a couple swings at guys who are on the borderline as long as it's not, I don't know, half your class, Richard Rodriguez. So, like, they were pursuing Jeff Jones late, the running back out of Minnesota, and he had a lot of grade issues that were
still hasn't taken the ACT.
So, and at some point they just decided that, well, we're just going to stop recruiting this guy because he might not qualify. Well, look at your
what's the downside?
Class. And, like, if he doesn't qualify, well, then he doesn't qualify.
And so, if he qualifies, that's an All-American running back.
Right.
And that guy looked really good in the Under Armour game.
And I know there's concerns about, like, having actual students as athletes, but, I mean, come on, man. Like, Michigan has a long history of bringing guys who are borderline. And if you're going to play big boy football, that is something you should do.
There's a positive thing in taking somebody who may be a borderline and then introducing them to the University of Michigan and giving them the proper support to where they can
As long as thrive. You make the correct effort to educate the guy and don't just, I don't know, Ole Miss it.
Yeah, or then, UNC it, apparently.
Yeah, then I'm fine with it. Like, you know, I don't have a issue with that. But we should talk about the guys that they actually did get.
Yes, we should.
Whoever they may be. So quarterback is Wilton Spate, 6'6", Navarre-type guy. Came in on the recommendation of a guy that Al Borges was a big fan of. Alabama did take a look at him, but kind of an unknown. Had a big senior season. Just maybe he'll be a developmental guy. Maybe he's going to be the next Navarre. Kind of a wild card.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a weird, enormous gap in his rankings where you've got ESPN calling him this on the borderline of the top 250 overall players, 4-star, and he's an Under Armour All-American, which is on ESPN, and, you know,
right.
You get some.
He was even higher earlier
there.
In the year.
And they started dropping him down after the Under Armour game.
He was on the fringe of the top 100.
Yeah.
I don't like people who get dropped at All-Star games, they usually get dropped for a reason.
Yeah.
And I think that is a statement that it means something, you know?
Yeah, and especially, you know, ESPN still kept him as a 4-star, but they dropped him pretty significantly down to the number 13 pro-style QB, and you've got him as low. Rivals doesn't even have him ranked among pro-style QBs. So you've got this pretty wide range here but mostly in the direction of three-star. And that's, I mean, it's not the worst guy to take the year after you take a borderline five-star like Shane Morris.
Yeah.
But when you're using, when you're taking just one quarterback in every class, you really want to have a pretty high hit rate. And with Spate, you know, what he did as a recruiter needs to also, I think, be factored in here, because he was one of the players instrumental in getting this class together. But as a prospect, there are some questions there about how he's going to perform. He's got a little bit of a wonky throwing motion. He did put up pretty darn good numbers in his, in his high school and senior year, but didn't do great at the Elite 11. Didn't do great at the Under Armour game.
The Elite 11 doesn't matter.
Is stupid, and they've just made it totally irrelevant.
Eight throws over four days or something.
Yeah. But his there are some concerns about his accuracy, and I think they're warranted considering his performance and under the lights and a couple of these scenarios. So we'll see with him. But he's got potential. When you got a 6'6" guy, you're not as worried about the fact that he throws it a little sidearm.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, I think the big problem still remains the fact that they didn't take a quarterback in the class ahead of Shane Morris.
Yeah.
Which,
and that's not something they should be covering for now.
So. No, they can't cover for it now, but still, that's the hole. It's not necessarily Spate. I do like a lot what they did at wide receiver. Of course, Drake Harris has lots of big play potential, 6'4" guy.
Indeed.
Didn't actually play as a senior because he was injured the whole year, but was explosive as a junior, had over 2,000 yards receiving. And, you know, put that in context. A lot of good wide receivers who are highly ranked wide receivers come to college and it's like, how many receiving yards did you have this year? And the answer is four, because they're playing with quarterbacks who can't even get them the ball. So Harris's junior season is really a remarkable.
He had over 90 catches.
Yeah, which is nuts. And a lot of those were just deep chuck it up and then go Braylon on it.
I mean, you watch his junior highlight reel and it's just a series of footballs flying very far in the air and then Drake Harris jumping in between three people and just high pointing it.
And I think the injury made people forget how electric he was as a junior.
But what's interesting is I don't think the recruiting services necessarily forgot, because he still ended up at 52 overall on Scout. His lowest ranking was 115 on Rivals. So for a guy to miss his entire senior season, sit out the Under Armour game, not participate in any camps after his, you know, after his senior year. I mean, he wasn't around at all after the summer after his junior year, and was injured actually for part of that too. He was injured heading into his senior season.
Absolutely.
So, and to stay that high is impressive.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think this guy is a bit underrated at this point. I mean, obviously the injury brings up the uncertainty level, but he did enroll early. So he will be not as far behind the curve as he would be otherwise. And, I mean, I don't necessarily think he's a lock to get a lot of playing time this year, but that's only because I think that the three guys they have on an outside receiver are very good. So
yeah, and with Harris, I mean, he is coming back from a torn hamstring. It'd be nice to give him a year where he could kind of, and he's also only 180 pounds or so, so it'd be nice to give him a year where he could kind of work his way up, especially since I think a guy we're going to talk about very shortly can, both guys, other receivers, can step in and play right away too if they need it.
Yeah, and Mo Ways is the other one, who is the kind of a Harris clone, and then he's a 6'4", very leapy outside wide receiver.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't really have the greatest hands as a junior, but put a lot of time into it as a senior. Had an excellent senior year statistically. I think he was up to something like 900 yards. And since that's an excellent year in high school, that should just make you think about what Drake Harris did as a junior.
Yes.
But he's a guy who his improvement track was good. And because he was, you know, in Michigan, committed to Michigan, nobody was really paying a whole lot of attention to him, despite.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot of movement in his recruiting rankings, even though you look at his senior highlight tape compared to his junior tape, and it doesn't look like the same player. He's way more impressive in how he catches the ball away from his body. He's bigger. He's blocking better. His routes are better. I mean, really, everything you could want to improve from a wide receiver from one year to the next, it happened with Mo Ways this year. So I think he's pretty underrated as a recruit right now. I think he's just a 4-star on one site, ESPN, and they've got him as the number 59 receiver, which is barely hanging on to 4-star territory.
Yeah.
I frankly think he's a better prospect than that, and I think he's got a pretty now Michigan, with getting Amara Darboh back, cracking the depth chart's going to be hard, but I think if somebody does it next year on the outside, it's going to be Ways.
Well, what they really should do is they should just redshirt both those guys.
Yes.
And roll with it.
But Ways is also a pretty good blocker for a high school wide receiver, as Tim Sullivan pointed out a lot when he was Tim checked out a bunch of his games this year.
Well, I mean, they
did some great scouting on him.
I mean, they brought in those three guys in the last class, and most of those guys are basically all outside guys, except maybe DeMario Jones could be a slot. So, you know, this is just my thing. Like, if the guy is not going to be a 20-catch, a 30-catch guy, just redshirt him.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I just think that when we get the Memorial, you know, freshman redshirt burned because of, you know, because we need him to block on these run plays, I think Waze is your candidate there because he's bigger than Harris and he's been healthy and he's a good blocker.
This is a futile argument because, of course,
they're going to burn it. They're going to burn somebody's redshirt.
Yeah, well, and they managed to burn two of the three guys last year.
Yep, and nobody remembers them making an impact at all except for DeMario Jones accidentally touching a punt.
Got hit by a punt, and that's his big contribution. It's just like, whenever I start talking about this, people are like, you can't do this because it's not an EA game, it's reality. I'm like, all right, just look at Wisconsin and Michigan State. Fifth years are a resource that you should use whenever you could possibly can. Anyway, the third wide receiver, Freddie Canteen, is, I think, everybody's sleeper of the year, except he's a four-star, so he can't be a sleeper of the year.
Yeah, he started out as the clear-cut candidate for sleeper of the year. Went back when we were entranced by Jungle Beats videos.
So mesmerizing Jungle Beats videos display a guy who has great feet and is your route artisan, who had a nice senior year at ECA and came in early as well. So he might be ahead of the curve. And unlike the outside guys, there is not a clear pecking order at slot. And even if there is a clear pecking order at slot, it consists of just two guys and maybe DeMario Jones. So this is a guy who I can see playing early and deserving that playing time and actually being a redshirt that I don't complain about.
Absolutely. The route running has been mentioned. I think that's the first thing that comes up whenever anybody talks about Canteen. He was kind of overlooked, I think, as a recruit for a long time because
they didn't play junior season.
So, that's going to get in the way of your exposure a little bit. And, yeah, he does have a pretty clear path to getting early playing time. Unfortunately, that might be at the expense of Dennis Norfleet, which...
That's my only complaint. But, hey, if they can't make Dennis Norfleet into a receiver, they are not long for this job. Is that a threat? Did I just...
I think he threatened the coaching staff with a firing, but yeah, I think he did. I'm not going to necessarily argue, but I do really like Canteen because he's got the short space route running in hands that you'd want out of a slot receiver where he's really quick.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see his some of the highlight reels from games from his senior year, and all of a sudden he's got this blazing fast straight line speed that was not really talked about before with him. So he's got the athletic ability that you want from a slot guy, and he's 6'1".
Right. Yeah. I was about to say that he's not 5'9", he's not 5'8", he's not 5'7". So a bigger target for underneath receiving, and I think we're all on the Canteen bandwagon.
Yeah. I think he'd be everybody's sleeper of the year pick if he qualified.
Right. And then the fourth member of the receiving type weapon guys is Ian Bunting, the 6'7" skillet-handed tight end, who's not really a tight end
not
right
really
now. He's about 210. Just think, it's just Funchess 2.0.
Really
he's actually
is.
Taller than Funchess. His hands are bigger than Funchess. I have no idea if he can block. He has no idea if he can block because he's never actually played tight end.
They did start playing him a little bit at tight end in his senior year where you see there's some like him playing with his hand in the dirt in line, but most of his highlights are him lining up on the outside
and
being way taller than people.
And I have a feeling that those kind of inline lineups are a lot like Funchess's inline lineups.
Indeed, especially at the high school level where blocking a guy can really be just push this tiny dude and then you're done.
So Bunting is probably in a red shirt because Jake Butt is around and they've still got A.J. Williams. And they're getting a couple of H-back types off red shirts from last year.
Yes.
So tight end actually seems well stocked for the first time in a while. And Bunting does need to learn to play the position and put on a bunch of weight. So probably a guy you store away for a year and then come back and see what you have.
Although if they want to bust out a goal line look with Funchess Butt and Bunting lined up out wide and just throw crazy fades everywhere, I'm okay with it.
You can't throw one fade to three dudes.
You can try.
But
just like a Hail Mary, just bunch them all up in the corner and someone's going to catch it.
Yeah, I have no idea if Bunting is ever going to be anything more than Funchess, but I like Funchess quite a lot. And he really just watching him catch passes is just like, I don't know how he's ever going to drop anything because he's just like, his hands are just enormous.
Yeah.
So I think he's a very good developmental prospect and You know, if they can get him up to 260 by his sophomore year, then I think Michigan will really have something.
And even if they don't, you can have a Fuentes redux where you just have this enormous matchup problem on the outside.
Correct. Two offensive linemen came in. Juwan Bushel-Beattie is also from Paramus Catholic, where Jabril Peppers came from. He's basically in the mold of a Logan Tooley-Tillman, where he's just a mountain of a man. Michigan is going to need some time to mold.
Yeah, he's 6'7", 310. I mean, so you've got kind of
310 is just a lie.
Yeah. he's probably closer to 280 or 290.
No, he's probably closer to 340.
Well, I mean, when you get all the fat off of him and then start building him back up.
Well, that's a very confusing way to say
Sorry,
that.
Sorry, that was a confusing way
he's
to say
He's a large, large man.
Yes, and he was in the Under Armour game and did not have a great performance there because he's this raw outside pass protector going against these not-so-raw pass rushers in that game. That game had a lot of really good edge rushers. So, you know, he's a developmental guy, but he's certainly got the frame that you want out of a tackle. And with those guys, you just kind of take as many of them as you can and you hope.
And then Mason Cole is more of a guard type, might be able to flip out to right tackle. Much more polished guy, actually impressed a lot of guys at the All-Star appearance. Obviously, they're going to redshirt him, but, you know, a couple years down the road, you might see him come through. He's an offensive lineman. There's not really a whole lot to say about them.
Nope. It was good in the Army game. That's about as much as we've got right now.
On the defensive side of the ball, Michigan brings in three guys, and this is really amazingly disappointing compared to what it looked like it might be. Lawrence Marshall is a 3-4 star tweener who's kind of a weak side defensive end. Brian Moan was pretty high up a lot of boards for a large portion of the year as a nose tackle. Did not perform well at the Under Armour game and fell down boards. And then Brady Palante is a 2-star Houdat out of Florida.
He ended up getting bumped up to 3 stars, but it was the token 3-star.
The token 3-star
to a good
bump,
school bump.
So he's got good optics. He's a wrestler, a state champion wrestler who could fit in that Mike Martin mold. But Mike Martin was also a 4-star slab of muscle coming out of high school, and Palante does not have anywhere near that profile.
No.
I don't necessarily mind bringing him in, but you're looking at three guys who might perform. And, you know, in August, it looked like Moan was a top 50 player and that they were going to add Malik McDowell and Deshaun Hand. And I don't know about Malik McDowell anymore. It kind of seems like he's just going to flame out wherever he goes because of drama. And those guys often flame out just because of drama. But not losing Hand's a kind of a downer. Understatement. A decent class. They have a lot of numbers on the defensive line, so they could get away with not having the elite crushers of doom coming in.
And
so,
Marshall, I think, is a pretty impressive prospect at weak side defensive end. He was another guy who came on a lot his senior year, where a lot like Taco Charlton's development from his junior to his senior year, where he went from, like, this guy is just a pass rusher and that's about it and skinny. Marshall is still pretty skinny, but Charlton added run support, really got disciplined, got bigger. Marshall got bigger. He's still only around 225 probably, although he says he's up to 235, 240 after the season. That's apparently where he played the offense defense bowl at.
There's too many of these things.
There are. I was not aware that one existed until Marshall played in it. But he's got great backside pursuit. He's a heck of an athlete for a defensive end, and if he can add some size and maintain that, it's kind of like Mario Ojemudia when he was coming in, where you hope the guy's able to bulk up and keep his kind of freakish edge athleticism going. Then there's Monet, who
is that? How it's pronounced?
I think it is Monet
instead of Moan.
I think it is. I think the E is not silent.
Well, then there should be an accent on it.
There should be.
Have we learned nothing from Sade?
Apparently not. but Monet, I'm torn because his junior highlights were extremely impressive. His senior highlights were up and down in terms of there were some plays where it just seemed like he didn't quite have the gear that he used to have as a junior. And part of that seemed to be that his weight was not necessarily under control.
Yeah.
And there's another part of it, which is that he was also playing on the offensive line, which doesn't show up in the highlight reel, but does show up in you getting gassed on defense. Yeah, so I think there are some mitigating issues here.
It does seem like Moan put on way too much weight way too fast.
Yeah, he ended up at like 338, and that is a lot.
Yeah, especially when you're going from, I think, 270 or something as a junior. So he really, really shot up there. So I think it's going to take him a while to get the kind of conditioning he's going to need. And Pallante is probably a redshirt as well. So I think most of this class redshirts, if they play Marshall with the three guys in front of him that they have.
That'd be pretty shocking.
I will bring a sign to the games that say, why are you playing Marshall? I'm terrible at signs.
Yeah, not really creative.
Terrible at signs. Linebacker class is four guys, except one of them is obviously defensive end. That would be Noah Furbush.
Yes, who they claim is going to play inside.
Who's just an enormous human being. Just like there's these shots of him at the OSU camp, and he just looks like...
The dude was 6'4", 240 plus as a high school junior.
He claims he's gone down to about 225, and I believe him. I just don't believe that he's going to stay there. It just seems like a weak side defensive end waiting to happen. Possibly a Sam linebacker, and absolutely not a middle linebacker.
No, he's just not got leverage issues there.
Well, and he's not going to be able to cover anybody. And like, it's just the weirdest thing that they think he's going to play middle linebacker or even weak side linebacker.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense in the world. And that probably is going to change the second he steps on campus.
But if he is Brian Urlacher, hooray.
That would be nice. I would accept a Brian Urlacher.
If he's not Brian Urlacher, then he's a defensive end. Chase Winovich was the subject of a heated recruiting battle between Ohio State and Michigan, won by Michigan despite Winovich's childhood OSU fandom. So there is hope yet for the little people out there. Not midgets. Children.
Just young Buckeyes.
And Winovich is interesting. He's basically a Jake Ryan 2.0 type guy. 6'4", will fill out to about 240 pounds, and is an ideal Sam for what Michigan
is. Yeah, right down to the blonde flowing locks. He's got that going too. So.
Well, they're not so flowing anymore, but they're bright. Not.
Yes.
It looks like he's got a highlighter on his head, which will make him fit naturally in Michigan's uniforms. The all-yellow look that is debuting any day now.
Why do we have to do this now?
Mike Ferns was actually the first guy in the class and helped recruit everybody else in it. As a result, he's kind of been overlooked, physically reminiscent of a Ben Gedion, very put together guy, great family, probably ahead of the game mentally. I think, you know, he's a guy who you might see play this year.
And similar to Gedion, a guy who was like a great all-around athlete at a smaller school, where he got to kind of just dominate at his level, which is good to see from an athletic standpoint, and then from an evaluation standpoint makes things somewhat difficult, especially since Ferns had a shoulder injury that he was dealing with through most of his senior year, and he sat out the Under Armour practices and game because of that injury, so we didn't get to see him go against top competition. And when you're in St. Clairsville, Ohio, which is right on the West Virginia border, you're not getting a great deal of football competition there. So it's a little tough to evaluate him, but he ended up as a four-star and inside as high as 129 on ESPN. The lowest he had was 311, so he's a guy who's got a pretty clustered group of rankings that all have him solidly within the four-star range. So he's got talent.
And then the last guy is Jared Wangler, Jack Wangler's brother and some guy's son. I forget who.
Yeah, just a dude who threw a pass at some point.
A Penn State commit who decommitted for Michigan when Michigan got interested because his last name's Wangler, so he's got to do that. Converted safety who's more of a weak side guy. Could actually play Sam if Michigan goes in the Stevie Brown direction.
Yeah, the small cover guy direction at Sam.
Which I don't think is a bad direction. I mean, Stevie Brown was pretty good at that when he was playing that spot late in his career. And then, you know, you've actually seen Michigan put a guy there who is of that mold in Alan Gant.
Yes.
So a guy who could play either weak side or strong side backer. And it's possible that maybe they have a nickel substitution there where they've got a nickel linebacker who comes in and he could be that. Not ranked very high, but the Penn State offer is pretty encouraging.
As was an LSU offer that came in after he committed to Penn State.
As now a favor to Les Miles.
Yeah, I mean, yes, but the Penn State offer is nice to see. He was named to the Under Armour game, which was interesting because he was a three-star across the board.
Yeah.
He was named to the Under Armour game, and ESPN did not move him up. They have him as the number 34 safety.
That's how you can tell that there's just too many people. There's too many of these games because a guy like Wangler would never have been at any of these games.
No, he wouldn't have been in the Army game when the Army game was the only game in town.
It used to mean something, and now it's just kind of like, well, you are a football player.
It's a participation medal.
Yeah.
For excellent participants for the most part, but still, there's a lot of them.
And then at defensive back, Brandon Watson is also from Eastern Christian Academy, the weird, like, David Sills school that's basically just a football factory.
Mm-hmm.
So he's enrolled early. He's just a jam fiend, man. His film is just all him at the line of scrimmage, just putting his hands on people.
Absolutely crushing people. And he's got size for a corner. He's 6 feet, 185. That's the direction Michigan seems to be going with their corners, and that they want them to be taller and more physical.
Right.
Unlike some of the corners from previous classes, Watson has actually filled out a little bit and has the size come from actual muscle instead of just being lean and really lanky. If I'm not allowed to pick Mo Ways, as everybody else has done, he's my sleeper of the year for this class because I really like how physically he plays on the line. There's also a limited selection of sleeper candidates, but
a limited selection of players. That is correct.
But his physicality at the line is really what separates him from most high school cornerbacks, most freshman college cornerbacks. Most guys aren't able to go up and play press coverage like he does.
But he should be a holy lock to redshirt. Just with the depth Michigan has.
Yes. And that is certainly the hope here, is that there is absolutely no need for him to see the field, because if there is, there are problems in the secondary.
There's not problems in the secondary. They've been hit with a plague. And then some guy named Jabril Peppers.
We don't really need to talk about him.
I don't think we even do. I mean, everybody who's listening to this podcast knows the entirety of Jabril Peppers' life story.
Yes, that's true, including apparently the video footage of his visit, which is now on the front page of our blog, thanks to Jabril Peppers uploading it.
I mean, Jabril Peppers is good at football and signed with Michigan, so hopefully he can be Charles Woodson immediately.
Yeah, that'd be nice. Do we have an idea of where his role is going to be on the field next year? Because there is going to be one, obviously.
I assume that what's going to happen is that he's going to be the nickelback to start out. It'll be similar to this year, where they fold Countess inside to that nickel corner, and then he'll play the boundary because there's less responsibility there. I mean, there's responsibility there, but it's simpler, and he can actually D up.
And he's a hitter.
Yeah. And, you know, those guys know their roles. And then it's possible that later in the season you could see him supplant Ray Taylor probably as the starting boundary corner.
He can also factor into the return game.
You know, Brady was kind of like, maybe not this year with him. I don't know
with Hoke in terms of him saying that.
You believe Brady Hoke at your peril. But
yes,
given what Norfleet did last year, I think he's got the kickoff job. I mean, I know that he got tackled by the shoelaces on every single return. But
I don't know how long you can keep Peppers from touching the ball at some point. And if they're considering as a freshman, they're probably not going to try to phase him in on offense too much while he's learning defense. I think putting him in on special teams is a pretty good opportunity to give the guy a chance to make an impact.
You don't want the guy returning punts as a true freshman, do you? I mean, maybe he's the best guy, but
I think there's a pretty good chance he is flat out the best guy. It's not like Michigan's return game has been that spectacular.
What return game?
Exactly.
I mean, it's college football. The punt return job barely exists anymore.
But he might. I mean, he's a guy who can actually break a tackle when he catches the ball,
sure,
and then actually give you a chance to maybe break something after that. I think with spread punts, you want a guy who's a little bit more physical of a returner, and that's not Norfleet. I love Norfleet as a returner and person in general. And,
come on.
But I think Peppers, I think he should have the inside track for at least one of the return jobs because you want the football in that guy's hands.
Well, what if you wanted it in Norfleet's hands? Come on, man.
Then give him some snaps at slot, for the love of God.
They couldn't even throw the guy a bubble screen. Like, just see what happens. You're averaging 1 yard a rush. Just see what happens, for the love of God. All right.
Borges is gone. We have to keep reminding ourselves of that.
Yes, we never forget. My sleeper of the year, as mentioned, is Mo Ways, because I have a limited selection of consensus 3 stars on 24/7, and he is the guy I think is the most underrated is Canteen.
Yeah, I'd say it's either Canteen or Ways, because Canteen actually got some pretty nice bumps. I mean,
he's still
top 200 on Scout.
Is he?
Yeah, in 174.
Well, then my most underrated guy is Bunting. How about that?
There you go.
And the only guys I really see making an impact this year are Peppers and Canteen. And that's nice because they don't actually have to stick anybody else out there. There's not really a role for any of these guys right now, which is the best thing.
Yeah, that is a good thing.
Like, no freshmen, please.
We do not have to run down a laundry list of true freshmen who are going to see the field because they have to.
And then there are like 3 or 4 guys who are just going to burn their red shirts in ways that drive me crazy.
Inevitably.
Anyway, what would you grade this recruiting class?
Yeah.
where they said it's really nice. You can't really diss them when they do bring in a high average star rating. I think it's like 6th in average approved rating in the 24/7 composite. So that's pretty good. And then they do have a Peppers. And most importantly is that it is a small class, and it was always going to be a small class.
Which deflates the team rankings that people freak out about.
I'm just saying that, what does a small class mean? It's that Michigan recruits are not leading the doors.
But Michigan has completed the number two class in the conference by a pretty wide margin, even with the small size. So, it's not by a wide margin if you ignore the size of the class, but when you take that into account at all, Michigan and Ohio State are far ahead of the field, with Ohio State being ahead of Michigan, certainly. But
yeah, and the methodology of the scouting services kind of sucks, because
there's a heavy emphasis on class size.
Right. So like Tennessee and their 34 recruits ranks 5th or something, and if you look at their actual star average,
it's not great.
It's not great. And so if you're not going to be in a conference that is just discarding people as quickly as possible to get a new lottery ticket, then having a small class like this is a viable way to become a Big Ten contender. I mean, a couple of years ago, I think Wisconsin had a class of 13 dudes.
They did.
And that's because they had room for 13 dudes.
Yeah. And last year, they took another pretty small class and gray-shirted a couple guys. So they can do this. And this can be successful.
And you look at Michigan State, where they kind of hemmed and hawed, and then they made the midseason decision to take the red shirt off Delton Williams. And that's the kind of approach that I think is wise. You're like, well, we could do something here. Here's this freshman, and we haven't played yet because we would like him to be here for 5 years. And look at the depth they've managed to have on their defense.
Yeah.
Just having guys around, and if they don't work out, they don't work out. But that 5th year is free, man. You don't have to give it to them because they already have a degree. Or in Michigan State's case, a piece of paper mache that says, good job. That's not fair.
No, but I enjoyed it.
Well, that's all I need. All right. We should probably wrap this up. Go team.
Thank you for listening to the MGO podcast. I am Ace Ambender, along with Brian Cook. Dual Blast of Vague Disappointment also describes last weekend, so that worked. Dual Blast of Vague Disappointment. God damn.